morning early, he went down along the shore and killed a stingray. At that point, he showed it on the high water, on the shallow water. Well, that stingray was bloody bait. The blood was what we were asked to get started with. So we went up here to Hippie Island, went along, but it was pretty calm, and we threw this shark. We went along up, so we went above it, and we dropped this line over. We had to use the life preserver for the cart to hold the light up the hook a little while.
Yeah.
And we waited a while, and by the water blew 10 feet. And this shark struck this bait. We said, well, if we got it. We went back down, there weren't any sharks. So we didn't know what to do. We didn't know the nature of these things at that time.
Right.
So, by and by, he came back. He got it. They killed their food before they take it to eat.
Yeah.
And that's what he done. The first time he struck this stingray.
Mm-hmm.
And then he went off. And then he came back.
Mm-hmm.
And took the bait. Well, he didn't give us any fight at all. We just took the line and pulled him right in. It was easy to tie. But when we got him up to the boat, we were going to put him inside the boat. His boat I have about 30 something off.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when he began to fight.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, we had enough of us out of 7 or 8 of us. We pulled him right inside the boat.
Wow.
He was 9 feet long.
I tell you, I wouldn't want him in a boat.
We caught a couple like that summer. That, you know, when we had the opportunity.
Yes, but I'll do what you do with sharks. You can't eat sharks, can you?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, you can?
Yeah, big sharks. I haven't tried at all. Now, yesterday I caught those six. They were two of them. One of them was burning at 14 miles. And
really?
I sent it, and my wife's sister was down with salsa.
Uh-huh.
And when they go to the market, they ask for sharks.
Yes.
And she was in her glory because I cut her skin to these sharks and cut them up for her. Yeah, she was around there. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
What is it like? What fish is it like, would you say?
Well, it's between a surgeon and maybe a sunfish.
I see.
Something
you can get
in it. It's fake meat. It's fake meat. Like there's no bone on a gristle. Don't have no backbone or a gristle.
Mm-hmm.
And you can slice it right up and just like little hamburgers, you see, and fry them. And it's very good.
Mm-hmm.
I like it. But my wife don't like it because it's called shark. It's called something else, you
know. But that is most interesting. I think your man is looking for you with a bicycle.
Oh, I must be something out here, neighbor, Marty. You're going right around.
I see. All right. I just don't want to interrupt you. Now, Bill, when you were explaining to me about sometimes the tides just staying high, and I would like to get that on tape, because I never understood that. I didn't realize they did that.
Well, the moon controls the tides.
Mm-hmm.
That's just as sure as what's happening here.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
When we have a full moon, we have a full tide.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And when we see that moon come up over there, it's high water on that surface.
Oh,
it's there. You see your eyes, it's high water. You can just pick it right out all the time just by her. Well, when she's in a different time where the moon is someplace and say she's in Pogey.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then when she's in Pogey, we have a poor runner tide. The tide don't run very fast. It doesn't come in too full. Doesn't go too much. It's just a slow tide. But then when she's out like she should be, I guess, then the tide comes strong.
Yes.
And the full of the moon is going to have a full tide.
That is most interesting. I didn't realize. I knew that the moon affected the tides, but I didn't realize that they just sort of skip it. So we had a couple of times that we lived here noticed that at a certain point we would have a tide so low that we would see things that, you know, up, particularly out there in Telescope, way up out of the water that we hadn't seen at all. And we have always wondered how that had happened because it just seems so terrible, you know?
Well, you've had some heavy northwest winds. Sometimes you have them here, and then sometimes you have them to push the water away from the land.
Right.
And sometimes it takes a week to get back like it really would unless the wind. Now, we're having these tides now that's so full. If we're having northeast winds and easterly winds that's pushing the tide in.
Yes.
Now, we had these same winds that push the tide out.
Yeah. We've had a constant northeast situation, it seems to me, since last fall.
Ever since the first of the year, we've had them every week.
Yes. We have northeast. Right after Byron went to college, it seems to me that they started and on and on. Not severe strokes, but just continual wind. I wanted to ask you, too, Bill, of and if you would explain to me about your guns, because we have never put anything about your guns on the tape, and I'd like to know what kind of guns you have used yourself. And, you know, for what...
Well, I've used all types of guns. I started that when I was about 12 years old with a single barrel 16. It was a gun that broke down. And
yeah.
Of course, before that, they had muzzle loaders.
Yeah.
And then I had double guns. And when I was 13 years old, a man in Baltimore gave me, from the 13th birthday, a Winchester pump gun, a shotgun, 1897 model. I got it right in there now.
It's
the old gun. I've got it for a suitcase. Well, I worked for this tuck shop for 18 years, and we done a lot of shooting. We shoot a gun every 2 or 3 years. And then gave me an automatic shotgun.
Yeah.
And I shot that until it began to get shackly. And then Mr. John Garner, the man headed the Jet Eagle Garner Company, that's the Garner Company, Bay Bridge, he had a special made gun. He had a straight stock into it. And he gave me that. And I shot that until I quit working with the club.
When you took a party out, what was your function? Now, you knew someone was coming ahead, did you? They let you know ahead. And then now, what did you actually do with them? How many people did you take and so forth? Just describe a party.
Well, they would be all the way from 6 to 8 in a party.
Mm-hmm.
You see, this club was a lot of membership, maybe 15 people.
Yeah.
And they had certain dates that they could take out and come down with their parties. Well, we generally had 2 parties a week. One would come in on a Sunday afternoon and go by Wednesday, and one come in Wednesday and go home Sunday. That's where we worked the whole season, too, for 3 months. My father was an old market shooter, and he knew the nature of fowl.
Yeah.
And he was head of the club, and he learned me boys what how to do. And we baited ducks for a long time.
Yeah.
Got them on the baited line, killed hundreds of them. I got some pictures in here I can show you. And that's the way we went to him until the club was. Until I left, but the club's still operating now.
Now, when you say baited, do you mean you put corn out?
We put corn out. We had a boxes on piling that would hold about 4 to 6 people.
Mm-hmm.
And we put a corn out in front of it.
Yes, I understand.
And then the ducks would get on the corn,
yeah.
And we would shoot them. We wouldn't shoot them away. We'd let them rest.
Yeah.
And we'd keep ducks clean in front of the blind for the people to shoot.
Mm-hmm.
Clean up until maybe a freeze came and the ducks went south and they would come back.
Yeah, I
see. Well, this club I worked for had a lot of marshland, and I think they had about 2,500 acres. Well, then we had these ducks out to the baited blind. It was up off of center function like more just below Green Run.
I see.
It was about 12 miles up down here. It's off of that to take deep, but it's island out.
Yes, I
if you had a chart, you said I could take you out all the islands where you could shoot on. They had shallow places where this eelgrass grew. And that was great goose feed.
Right.
And we used to kill a lot of geese off of there. Well, see how we worked it. We take low a days. We weren't in slow a days when we didn't want to shoot the blind. We'd go shoot the geese. And we killed about 70 wild geese one day. And they killed a lot of fowl.
Well, now, Bill, when a party came down here, what were they really asking? Did they want numbers of wildfowl to take home, or were they at a particular time? What was the hunters who came to a club hoping to do? Was he hoping to shoot a lot of things, or was it just to have fun to take home and the sport to be home?
Well, at first, they just wanted to shoot take home.
Mm-hmm.
But the more they killed, the more they wanted to kill.
Yeah, yeah, right.
And it was him who could take home the biggest bag of fowl.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And after a while, it got so he couldn't satisfy them.
Yeah, I believe it.
We were getting this down to it. We used a lot of live decoys.
Yeah.
Wild geese decoys and quacking ducks. And for the last, we were using flyers.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes, we used flyers to bring the ducks in.
I see. How could you use the flyers?
Well, there wasn't any trick to it at all. We had these little ducks, we call them puddle ducks, or little quackers.
Yeah.
We'd have them in a pen, and we'd have the drakes in there, too. 2 or 3 drakes in with these little ducks. And the little ducks, we'd crap their wings so they couldn't fly.
Uh-huh.
And they were the ones we put a strap on the leg with a ring into it and a hook. And we anchored them right over in the water. But these drakes, we took, they let them fly. So we'd take them into the blind with us. Sometimes we had concrete pits or even even if it was a push fly and stuck around you. We had a little crate we kicked these drakes in. We used about two of them. And when we got out, we saw a duck off. When we saw the duck off there flying, saw our decoys, we would take this drake in our hand and we'd throw him right up. And he would fly over the decoy. The little duck would quack at him. He would lay down in the water from the shore well. The trick to get him back was we had a little cart, not no bigger than your thumb, just a cart stopper out of a big bottle.
Uh-huh.
And we tied it to a little piece of fine fishing twine. And when we rolled up on this cart, this twine, and tied to the duck's leg, and when we threw him out, that would unwind. And then when he got in the water, we got the little cart going to it. And we don't trip to it at all, and while the little ducks were used to him, when he flew out, they quiet, and they would bring out a duck in his
feet. What? Jesus, my word.
Yes, sir.
Somebody's pretty smart thought of that, sir.
Yeah, we were getting it down fast.
Yeah, and I thought it looked better than just a floating decoy, didn't it?
Yeah, and then they passed law that we couldn't use any law because at all.
Oh, is that? What did they tell us that, when was that? What was that?
That was back in, that's been 30 years ago, I guess. Maybe back in 1940, 50.
I see. Yes, I don't know about that.
When they passed the law. See, at first, when they first began to shoot, you could mark it foul. I could go up there and feel wildfowl and walk down the street with them on a pole, and people would find them.
Yeah.
But after they passed that law, you couldn't sell anymore. Why? And that put a stop to it. That's all I
need. When you did this, when you were just shooting yourself without shooting for a party, and as you said, I was going to ask you about how that worked in town. Now, did people in the, did you sell any ducks for us here on Chesapeake people, or did they all supply themselves pretty well?
We would sell them here on Chesapeake because there's a lot of people that didn't do any hunting at all.
Right.
And we would sell them, and they were took to the farm because it was a good dish.
Yeah. Oh, I suppose.
And even after the law closed, we used to sell them just the same. Keep the game warden in mind.
Mm-hmm.
And people would buy them, and even today, you had them, and people knew you had them, and they would tickle to death and want them to eat.
Right, I'm sure that's true. What did you get, Bill, when you first started at that? What would a table duck that someone would buy here on the island, what would you think of it?
Well, the black mallard would be the duck that they would be after. What would they would buy in a con, or any in a canvasback, or a bycat, or a golden eye, any kind of duck, even these magansers, and spring of year, you could get 50 cents a pound for them.
Yes.
And sell all you could kill, but the game was good and lucky.
What happened if you shipped them away? Did you make any more money if you shipped them away?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I got a lot more money. Redheads was up, named up around here. And my father would shoot black mallards, only got $1.05. He didn't want wasted ammunition, but he would shoot the redhead ducks. And he would ship them into New York. And he would get hired at $3 and 50 cents a pound. They were marketing for wildfowl in New York City just like every state today.
Yeah.
You could ship them right in just like you do this.
Why would you get marked for a redhead? Is there a difference in taste?
He's a different taste in duck. He's got red of meat. Yeah, there's a different taste.
Isn't that right? Yeah.
He was a marketable duck. And I've heard my father say he's killed hard 120 in an afternoon. The only way they would do this, they didn't go out here hunting every day.
Mm.
They would watch these ducks and these big flocks get to feed. You know, a fowl is just like a person. They have certain things they do.
Yeah.
Certain places they feed. And that's what they would do. They would get to feed in a certain place. Mm-hmm. And my father sometimes would watch those fowl for a week or two until he got the wind right.
Huh.
He got everything right. And then he would go there.
Yeah.
He had his brother had a sailboat. Wasn't no traffic on the water in those days like there is now. So he had a brother done the sailing. My father done the shooting. And his brother would sail. Just sail all around, all that long. Just get these ducks.
Yeah.
Well, when these ducks would leave while they were feeding, and went up somewhere else and fished on the water, well, then when you scared them up again, they'd come right back to where they'd been feeding before.
Even though you had been shooting in between, the shooting didn't register.
My father had two guns he used. He used a double barrel of number 8 shotgun.
Mm-hmm.
And then he had one of these Browning automatic shotguns. They'd just come out. There weren't about 8 or 9 of them built by Browning before they sold it to the Remington people, and that was the Remington guns. Well, when the big floss came in, like 50 or 75, he'd take the big gun. And he'd line them up and get all they could, but when 2 or 3 came, he would shoot them with an automatic gun, one at a time or two at a time, because he didn't want to waste those big shot on two get two or three ducks.
Well, now, will you explain to me, because I don't know the difference. What was the advantage of the automatic? How many times would you shoot an automatic?
Well, an automatic shot five times.
Five.
And a man good with it could, in a flock come by, because they would be close enough in that sometimes he'd kill four or five. That wasn't each shot. Yeah, my father was one of the most wonderful duck shots that I ever knew. He was really wonderful. He was setting the blind. We were to the working for the club, and the guest there, and he'd set this blind, and he'd say, seven ducks are coming. And he'd say, boy, I'll bet you a dollar I'd kill every one with three shots. And then ducks would come in. Of course, they would light into the decoys. He killed three or four the first shot, and he had two together, bang, and bang, by three shots, killed by one. And did it right along. Well, that was his livelihood. And back when he first started, he had to make it load his own ammunition.
Yeah.
And he had to make every shot count.
Yeah.
And most of the time, he figured, even if they weren't but three or four ducks, to get all four of them with two shots.
Yeah.
And he always taught me how it was done. And he'd duck the light of his decoys, and he would get two or three in line, and there would be one or two over here that would be close to line. Well, he was fast enough that he would shoot these, and shoot, when those jumped and went together, he'd kill them both in one shot. Well, he said, whenever you shoot a bunch of fowl, you want them to go this way, you shoot, they always jump away from where the shot is from work. And he had that all figured out.
Shoot your own decoy.
Well, it's a shot when you couldn't hurt it because they're made out of wood. Yeah, a lot of these wooden decoys, you find that, they got the hill shot in them. Now, we never did kill any ever live decoys, did we?
Yeah.
We always had them off on the end or back or out here while we were
doing
the work. Well, they did when they first started, when they went to the houseboats.
Mm-hmm.
But when the tub got built, this folks on the tub was a money-making proposition.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you take the Griner Company, he owned big stock into it.
Oh, is that right?
And Simon Tenenwayne, they owned big stock into it.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
And what they would do, see, Simon Tenenwayne, they manufactured railroad parts.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he would come down, and he would bring with him the president of the Pennsylvania Railroad or some other president, some other railroad, or the executive engineer or some other purchasing agent.
Yeah.
See, they were bringing down, and when they went back home, actually, they were going to give him the clothes. I quit working for the club. I was while I'm at it myself, I had a piece of land up here and had a little house. We got duck shooting. So one night we've been out duck shooting on our way in with a little motorboat. And I seen these three fellas on this island with a duck line, but I knew who they were. One of my brother-in-law was the guy. So this fellow wavered, so he knew me, and we went in. It was Major Allen, the fellow that was headed to get United. And he had the commissioner of the state roads in Maryland, the head commissioner with him. Well, we didn't know what was going on, but right after that, when the Chesapeake Bay Bridge started to be built, they talked business. While they were in that line and watching the ducks come in, well, they talked business.
Yeah, right.
So that club, I don't think, owed anybody any money.
Yeah.
And Mr. Kenny from Baltimore, he'd come down and he was a salesman. Well, he knew Mr. Garner quite well, and a lot of time, Mr. Garner, we want 1,000 gallons of paint to paint some bridge they built. Well, he'd give that to break.
Right.
And he would get the paint and commission on it. That's where he made a living.
So are you?
What year is it?
What year is it? About how old were you then in there with you?
When I first started, I was 13 years old.
Yes,
and I worked for them for 18 years. I was a young man when I left out of there. And I went on morning and got the braids and bought a chicken. After that, I went to the real man.
Right.
Went into a few different businesses. Seemed like another good. All of made a good living, though.
How did you feed these people when they came?
Oh, we had a cook.
Okay.
Father. Well, it was done. See, my father, he managed the club. He furnished all the food. And the waiter and the cook. And they paid so much a day that the owner paid so much a day for his guests, maybe $5 a day for the each, and that's all it cost only, he would have about a $250 or $300 a year dues to pay. That's my picture when I was.
How old were you,
No, I weren't that old. 12 or 13 years old. That was in the summertime.
Why? It looks like an old picture. Isn't that Becca? What is that that you're holding in your hand?
Oh,
see that moon beating off. Oh, my word. Now, that is really eating on
that. That was before the cut was built.
That looks like a fly, but that
was before the old houseboat. My father had a houseboat like that. Had two rooms in it.
Oh, I'm glad to see that picture. Let me show that one. Now, who do you think that was, Bill?
It was Sweetie. That is the fellow in the moon, isn't it?
Blue Windhole.
Blue Windhole.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was.
Really, I dressed up very
nicely. Yeah, one of the executives of a big whiskey company. I don't know what brand it was. But anyway, when Prohibition came, they went to make a vinegar and make a gun, I guess.
He's very eloquent. Well, we're doing.
We were up to it. What finished the chicken? That's what the big man is called. He's quite a little fellow. I was wondering, you had either go raise him or quit.
Yeah, yeah.
You had something out here, some of the pictures that you take up at another time.
Oh, goodness, that interesting. Oh.
And some of the kills were made.
Yes, my word.
And we're later some morning, we'd been out and killed that man, and we were going to the house, and somebody standing and picked out who it was.
My goodness.
And that was my father.
Oh, and this is your father's house out there.
And the fellow with him with his arm around his shoulder is a Kenny, Nat Kenny.
Isn't that? Oh, that's a good picture, isn't it? My word. Boy, now look at the boots. They're really standing ready for action. Look at the chicken.
That's another pretty picture. Oh, we have
a chicken picture now.
Yeah, that's my father and my sister. That's my chicken.
So, in other words, was your father in this business too, Bill?
No.
He just happened to be there.
He was manager of the club until he died.
My goodness. Now this club, does this exist at all now?
Yeah. That's the back porch. You see us around there. And
look
at it. I think you got one of the eating oysters.
My.
Or most anything that you had, not so wild, the nicest one we ever had. He could make the best kind of bread, but he never touched it with his hands.
Why?
He did it with a spoon instead of making it all like people do with hands. He would do it with a spoon. And he would put... Quite a family of
things on here. Yeah. Now, apparently, the Wilton, one
and a half quarter weight, or maybe a third weight.
Yeah.
Al's grandmother was a white woman.
Right. Well, this, you know, this Annie Britton looks so white, I thought she was white.
Yeah.
And so I can believe that they had white blood, you know, blood in them. You never heard anybody talk about this Easter. That is, it's the funniest thing.
The only Easter I know of, it was a doctor came here from Dr. Easter.
Is that right? Uh-huh. Yeah, but she had no last name. She just listed his name. But it could be, that could be her last name. It could be, I was thinking it was her first name, but it could have been her last name. It could have been Anna Easter, and it could not just not have been that. How about old Les? There was 11 walkers who worked for the walk when Victoria Pruitt was alive, apparently. And he said to some newspaper reporter that he had such beautiful white teeth. This newspaper reporter said, you know, he had beautiful white teeth. And he said, yes, he had such beautiful white teeth. And he said his master, using an O, he said, my master was offered $1,800 for me once because I had such beautiful white teeth. Apparently, his master had released his slaves right after the war, which is a mistake, and had told them he'd try to pay them, but he just wasn't able to, you know, there's just much too much money. So they came over. These articles, these newspaper articles, seem to emphasize that quite a few of the colored people came to Chicago after the war became a fair, so they were freed. A lot of them were custom slaves, apparently, and they, the fishers were all custom slaves, and they came here and settled in here for some time. Now, there was somebody in 1930. There were two people alive, a Charlotte Glasgow and an Aunt Mammy. But did this ring any bell to you at all? And they had been custom slaves, and I think they were fishers. Well, I'm not sure whether they're fishers, but I know they were alive in 1930.
Yeah, we had a colored family of fishers.
Mm-hmm.
Lived up here, what we would call a people, or
because the Britneys lived down.
That's right.
Way down there, they talk about. That's what you think about this. We have
watch, which we would expect, because those were the three earliest, so that would be expected. The Claybills.
Tables.
Yeah.
I'm
going to
say the name. There are a lot of the tables. I don't
know if I
go back.
Yeah. And the Mason, the Babbitt, the Jones, the Lewis, the Thurston. Now, is that a name
for
the Mason?
Thurston. Yeah, I've heard the name quite often. I don't know anybody by that name. But you're speaking about the Lewis. Uncle Ken married a Lewis.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Well, that could very, and that could very well be the Lucy. Now, Hill, also, the Andrews, and possibly, they said the Thorntons, but they weren't sure about the Thorntons. Now, Andrews, is that the name? Does that ring a bell to you?
Yes, that's a very familiar name.
It is.
And I knew a lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe a generation or two back.
Yeah, I don't think there's a name now, but that could very well be. Also, one article, Bill, said that, try to find it here. Well, in 1947, one of I think it was 75 years ago or something, article said that John Birch's father, who was a lighthouse keeper or something, a lifesaving service or something, and a John Watson had both said that they recall in their lifetime seeing up where the White Hills are now, the bones of an old Spanish wreck. And both of them said that this was true, that they're two different people, they didn't see it together. This would have been clear. Now, of course, this article was talking about Spanish wrecks and ones that had been in North Carolina. They were trying to prove that one had come in there. But they said that these two people had definitely seen these bones of this old Spanish wreck at different times where the White Hills were now. Now, whether that means, they said it was a beach. Now, I suppose that beach, before that town was there, that Aspie town, could have come up farther, and it's possible there could have been a shipwreck there. How they would know it was a Spanish wreck, I don't know, but there probably is some way.
Well, there was ways the older people could look back at an old wreck and the way it was built.
Yeah.
They could tell from pretty well what country built it.
Right. Every so often somebody says something about a wreck built that had wooden pegs in it. Now, what would wooden pegs indicate? Is that just the way that some people made boats?
Instead of bolting the boat together, they would put it together with wooden pegs.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I had an old, what they call a knee. A knee is a timber that comes off the tank down the side.
Oh.
It's made like a V.
Oh.
And this timber that I had found is had wooden pegs in it, and then it had just one or two arm bolts for the rest of the wooden pegs.
Interesting.
And long as we're on the subject of this wooden peg, up the green run where my father lived when he was a boy, when his mother remarried, went there. I've been up there, and it was houses built without a nail on it. They would put the sill down and drill some for the peg. And everything was pegged, even the shingles on the roof. We're paid to pay, but on the page, not a nail in the house.
Well, I don't know why a good, strong pay wouldn't be just as good as something that
would last longer than a nail.
Yes, I would believe it, and I think it would swell. Some of the problems with nails would be usually that probably would be, interesting. Now, somebody, the Washington Star, in 1938, was describing the ponies, the early ponies, before they had been bred so much. And they said that they were smart and treacherous and wary, and that they would throw a man and attack him like a dog. Now, I would like to know whether that sounds to you that that's just some reporter throwing off the deep end, or what's the deep end of the
star? Well, they were wise ponies.
Yeah.
And they would fight like a dickens, but when you're broken, you may win a nicest pony you've ever seen in your life. No, they didn't fight. We didn't have it like we used to. My father used to raise them. We used to bring them home there.
Yeah.
Take the ponies.
And you don't remember anybody ever saying that they had been terribly, terribly treacherous.
No, they've always made.
Probably some reporter who came down for, for ponies having and rolling up well.
He might have seen one that.
Right.
No, we had one home. My father always had ponies. We were home. We had one that called Old George. And we kept him around the house there, and we'd eat from the table out of the night in the summer, and he'd stick his head over and give him a biscuit. He was one of the family.
Yeah.
And one time we had another piece of property about, oh, yes, half a mile away that the father rented. Had a lot of tax land, and we would go back, and father and son-in-law lived there, and then we'd sell this land. And this pony, we brought him back with the father. We had in front of the house down next to the road, we had a big gate, we call them. It was a gate large enough for the drive a horse cart through.
Oh, yeah.
But you always had to open that gate when you got in there. So one day I came there with him, and I started to get off, open this gate, and I caught a cramp and both legs fell right underneath the horse.
Oh,
and his horse was stepping around because I was holding his bridle.
Mm.
And he put his feet on my chest. And he would drag that foot over until he was sure that foot was on the ground before he finally went.
Yes.
And there they had a funny thing.
Yes, exactly.
We thought the world of it.
Yeah. I would think, well, my word, it isn't that. You remember, now I got an article that Captain Bromley, who was the keeper at Green Run, said, and somebody else said too, but I didn't get the other man's name, that he recalled a couple of tremendous northeast winds after big storms, so the northeast winds were really behind. He remembered seeing almost 2 miles out under what would ordinarily be water. When this tide pulled way back, marsh mud under the sand, and in it was the footprints of animals like cattle. Have you ever remember any story like this?
Yeah, you can go up here along the ocean and go way back out in the spray that would be covered on a high water view upon tree stump. Yes,
so that marsh must have gone out there.
And they had cattle, even in those days, way back there, they owned these. They were people owned cattle those days, they just turned them loose.
Yeah, right.
You
do?
Oh, yeah. That Dr. Field. And one Sam took up his land. It was Dr. Field.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
He took his land up for 10 cents. I think it was 10 cents an acre.
Oh.
And then he didn't molest the people at all. Even when I was a boy, my father's courtesy and go across the seas up here, Dr. Field didn't bother us. Seemed like he was an old friend of some of theirs. Maybe he was older than my father.
Yeah.
Dr. Beale, man, I've heard his name hundreds of times.
Is that right?
But it was Sam later that took his land up. And Sam didn't bother anybody for years and years. And then he went and got a man by the name of Oliphant.
Mm.
And this man was trying to get up a dollar out of everybody. He getting that thing up.
Yeah.
And in the end, he wound up selling Sam Beale about $20,000. Was Sam died, but Miss Nellie Fields,
yes,
was Dr. Fields' daughter. She
yes
married Dr. Burwell.
Right.
And they had a home here, a nice home on Church Street.
Right.
I know Dr. Burwell very well. And knew Miss Nellie very well. Of course, they're all gone now, but they were.
Well, I was curious. Now, this doctor that you were hearing about, was he a medical doctor?
I suppose he was.
I think he could have been both a medical doctor and a teacher.
He could have.
And it was the right period of time. Now, that's interesting you said this about the Brewer, because I have a very interesting bit here somewhere. And I have to ask you about this. I asked Matt about it, and I got an interesting reaction from him. I want to see what you. Well, I want to ask you two things here. Let's see. I want to ask you, now we talked about that round top house. Do you remember about that? We talked about that octagon house that was in on Main Street. And I had some more information. I just want to tell you about it because I think this is good information. It was built in 1866, and it was built as a customs house. And I don't know whether Cock or Cork, or C-A-U-L-K, whether they built it, whether they owned it. I don't know what their connection is, but it was called the Cork House or Cork House. And that existed until 1945. Now, if Mrs. Joliet Smith was in it at one time, and she may have been a Cork, I don't know. There were some Cocks. Dr. and Mrs. N.S. Smith were related to the Cork family, and Miss Birdie, who talked to you about. Shreve Winbrow was telling me that his wife had lived in the Cock House for a while, but not that it was a custom house. And apparently in 1945, I don't know how the Disbrows got this, but somehow they owned it.
Yeah.
And Mrs. Disbrow, after he died, in 1945 gave this to Winder to tear down. And in the process of tearing it down, in the attic, he found the old book about the commission of this as a custom house. And he found the
the street.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That house itself is right along the edge of the shoulder.
Yes, right.
The water washed up to
maybe
the foot of the yard.
Yes, right.
All the buildings across the road, the lowly house and all of those,
mm-hmm.
it's all filled in land.
Right. Well, that makes sense, because it seems as if you'd have a customs house close to the water. And that was the other thing. Why would there have been a customs house on Chantecy? What would you want a customs house?
I can't imagine.
It could be the first landing place
for something like that. There was a lot going on at that time. I could still watch them on Virginia line,
that
might be here.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know if we were in Virginia and Maryland at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And they were having quite smart delegations going to work, trying to get to find out something, how to do it, and what was going to happen,
right.
and how they were going to be protected. And we had on the island here, we had both northern and southern soldiers.
Right.
So they could have a couple of times there.
Yes.
And maybe in those days, for the boats, there was a lot of boats that traveled in and out of here.
Right, and this could have been the first place they landed, couldn't it?
Yeah.
Before they landed on
yeah.
mainland. Yeah. So they could have had to go through customs here.
Right.
That would have been if it were built, as it, apparently it was built and commissioned as a customs house first. So if this were true, that would be 1866, that would be right at the end of the Civil War, and that would make some sense. Well, I just wanted to be sure I told you about that, because I thought
well,
it was very interesting.
Speaking about customs here now, when the sailboats went up in Maryland, they come through Chincoteague, and went up that way, and they would have had to pass through the customs here to go into another state.
That's true. I hadn't thought about that. That is true, but it could have been for that.
I remember when they were coming later when the line was followed up. It used to be years ago, there was a lot of sailboats in the sea loaded with oysters and sea oysters flying down the
ground.
And naturally, what it was, you see, this custom is a tax on this stuff.
Mm.
Like a boat going to the North Carolina and getting sea oysters planted in Maryland, he had to come through here,
yes.
see how many oysters you had,
right.
and maybe someone could get them.
Right. Yeah.
I imagine that's what it would be before.
Have you any idea? Nobody can seem to remember any members of the Hope family. Have you any idea who's now this Hope was here within people's memory? Do you have any idea who her family was?
Yeah, it's Hope was my second cousin.
Is that right?
And her mother was Uncle Jim's sister.
Oh my word.
Yeah. And they came and
all. No, I'm asking you. Now people put the question and nobody is going to answer.
Yes. And Holly. And Holly Hope. The cousin sister's mother.
Right.
And there was a sea captain coming here, Captain Hope. An old Englishman, I guess he was. He came in here. There was a lot of traffic in here with big sailboats in those days. And this Tom Cove out here was the only cove there, a place for refuge they'd go and saw him. They'd all come in here. And she married this Captain Hope. And,
Was she an island girl then? Was she an island girl?
Yeah,
had this Hope always lived here?
Yeah, she was. She lived her all life. Sister Hope did, and her mother was born. Because she was a sister of the Kent.
Why, isn't that interesting?
And my father always called that Holly, and then they got all called it cousin. She was a sister. No, her sister was her name.
Yeah.
And she was a cousin to my father.
Why, that bucket?
I knew her very well.
Well, you know, there's a great fondness for her on the island. But I had no idea. So she married the captain who came in here. Isn't that interesting? Well, I just about decided that she was not, that her family at least was not from here, and I had my delighted
here. You see, the fucking cemetery down here is only certain people are buried into it.
Yes.
And she was in the family, and that's why she's hurt.
And so Hopes were also related to Bunning.
Yeah, oh yeah. See, Aunt Holly was the Bunnings, like Bill Bunning, and Aunt Ken Bunning.
She was a great favorite on one of the Mrs. Wheels. Yeah. And that she used to send me a poem up to her in a little allowance until she died. Because she was, you know, was very, very fond. Do you remember, well, we got this story in about three different forms from very confused newspapers. Bill, you told me the story initially. Remember that man on Africa that was captured and carried around during the revolution? What's his name, Birch? Do you recall? Now, the story in the paper, and I didn't bring this as a direct quote.
It's a Birch of Thornton.
Yeah. About this yesterday, and she said, I think he was the first minister.
of the, now was this the Methodist Episcopal at that time, or was that?
I don't even know, brother. It was more